We're going to pick up our study in James chapter 3 in just a moment, but before we do, let's just review that the theme that we're following in this letter is this idea of living our faith. And this includes what we've seen so far is living by faith includes living it in the midst of trials without. They come from without upon us. We fall into, is the wording, and temptations that come from within. That is when we're drawn away by our own lust, our own desires, and enticed. Also, we've seen this idea of living by faith in relation to the Word of God. And that is to be not only hearers, but doers also. Living by faith in relation to our fellow man. We saw that at the end of chapter 1, where we saw that pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit the orphans and widows in their affliction, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. And then he continued in the first part of chapter 2, speaking about how we ought not to show personal favoritism toward others. Partiality is the word. And that's in contrast, really, to what he says in verse 8, which is, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So living by faith involves how I relate to my fellow man and the actions and the words that I have toward him. Living by faith recognizes, then, I will recognize that faith is more than belief, but faith that pleases God is a faith that works and does what God says, that is, works of obedience. And living by faith now is what we look in verse and chapter 3, living by faith in relation to my tongue and how I use my tongue. And then we'll see these others as we go through the rest of the letter. So living by faith, we said early on that living by faith starts, of course, with a right relationship with God. I can't live my faith except that I am in a relationship with God through Jesus Christ. And that I have obeyed him and been saved, and now I can walk by faith. Living by faith requires the right attitudes, the right words, also the right actions. We'll see that as we go on through the letter this morning in chapter 3. Does anyone have any comments or anything before we begin reading in chapter 3? All right. Beginning in verse 1, my brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment. For we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man, able also to bridle the whole body. Indeed, we put bits in horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body. Look also at ships. Although they are so large and are driven by fierce winds, they are turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires. Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire by hell. For every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and creature of the sea, is tamed and has been tamed by mankind. But no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. With it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? Thus no spring can yield both salt water and fresh. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing will be there. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. Now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Living by faith involves controlling my tongue, and he first addresses this idea of becoming a teacher. My brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment. One of the questions in the material we handed out a few weeks ago was this one: do you think that James does not want Christians to teach? Is that what he's trying to say here? All right. If he were saying that, he'd be contradicting other inspired writing in Acts chapter 8 and verse 4. For example, brethren in Jerusalem are praised, shown to be good in the way it's recorded that they went everywhere preaching the word. These were not the apostles. These were just Christians, ordinary Christians like you and me. In Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 12, the Hebrew writer says here, by this time, you ought to be teachers. You need someone to teach you again the first principles of the oracles of God, and you've come to need milk and not solid food. In 1 Timothy 3 and verse 2, one of the qualifications of an elder is apt to teach or able to teach. And we've been discussing Wednesday night how that these are attributes and characteristics that we all should want to have, all should strive to have. Apt to teach. In 2 Timothy 2 and verse 2, Paul specifically tells Timothy that the things that he's received, that he needs to commit these to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. So what is it then that James is trying to say here by saying, let not many of you become teachers? Guy?
I think it goes back to the idea of the responsibility in teaching.
Okay, go ahead.
The word, you just look at the scriptures, it's only in Christ can a soul be saved. And that's the only way. And the only way individuals are going to know of Christ is by being taught the scriptures. And I guess we can look out there today and see how much error is being taught in the name of Christ. Mm-hmm. People teaching the scriptures with confidence and assurance and boldness, and they are teaching a false gospel. So who teaches the truth? Who is teaching a salvation, a word, who is teaching salvation? And it's those of us that are Christians. And just like in Timothy, where Paul is giving him, be sure that you are teaching a true gospel, a true doctrine. That is not being added to or taken from, but the truth is being taught. And only in that word being taught is a soul going to be saved. So it's the responsibility to, one, know that word, and two, to take the action to teach that word.
Okay, good. God wants there to be teachers in the local church, does he? Does he want there to be elders or pastors?
Yeah.
Ephesians chapter 4 and about verse 11 or so, he said in the church, and one of those mentioned is teachers. He wants there to be teachers. It's almost as if this verse is a warning, then, to be taken as a warning, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment. One doesn't aspire to be a teacher, and we're all teachers in some way. We teach by example, of course, whether we want to or not. But we teach children. So we all find ourselves at times teaching, and hopefully teaching the lost. It seems that this would be something where, it could be something where someone is more of a public teacher. And one might be inclined to say, well, there's some kind of notoriety or some kind of position to be had in being a public teacher. But he's warning here, that's not the right attitude. You recognize how serious a responsibility you're taking upon yourself to teach the word. Because by our words we'll be judged, and as Guy said, when false teaching is taught, then people are led astray, the blind lead the blind, and they both fall into the ditch. And many have been influenced by that which is false. It's sad to look at that and think about it. So again, I think we have the right idea. It's more to be taken as a warning. Yes?
Right. Like in Revelation, it says, don't add to or take away, or the plagues of this book will be put upon you. That's a strict warning. And you look at Billy Graham, how many people he led astray because he taught baptism was not necessary. And he's going to have that punishment that God promises.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't want to be in those shoes, huh? When you talk to so many that are religious today, that are more of the community mindset, it is what they say about salvation pretty much goes back to the things that Billy Graham taught. The idea of receiving Jesus into your heart, or in order to be saved, simply receiving him into your heart, saying the sinner's prayer. These things are so common. Oh, they'll add baptism in, but not as a requirement for salvation. So it's not the baptism taught in the New Testament any more than when my brother threw me in the canal and we were swimming and he threw me in there. I was immersed, but it wasn't for anything but fun. That's not baptism. It's not Bible baptism for the remission of sins. Yes?
You know, on the opposite side of that, let many of you not become teachers because of the responsibility. But then again, as you pointed out in Hebrews chapter 5, there's that condemnation that's going to fall on those that have no knowledge and are not able to teach.
That's right.
So, in saying that and stuff, what is the idea of not many, let not many? I mean, I think that's the idea of that scripture, I think, is what we've discussed. But what's that idea of let not many? I mean, that really gives the idea of not everybody should be teachers, which is not...
Yeah, again, I think it's just a warning.
Yeah.
Yeah, just meant to be taken as a warning. Why do I want to be a teacher? We ought to ask ourselves, why would I want to take on that and be a teacher? That ought to prompt me to ask that question. Yes, and then can...
So it's not saying do not become a teacher.
No.
Can we say that?
I believe so.
That verse is not saying do not become a teacher.
That's
because
right.
It's not saying that.
Right. Kenny?
I think I got it there at the end.
Okay. All right. So does this have any relation to the rest of the chapter? And I believe it does then, because he goes on in verse 2 and he says for. And for can mean for the purpose of, or for can mean because of. In this case, it's a because we all stumble in many things. It's almost as if that could have just been connected with verse 1, the people who split things into verses, because we all stumble in many things. So there's another part of that warning, the carefulness that has to go into teaching, and being careful in teaching. We all stumble in many things. Now, almost as if a segue into this discussion about the tongue that goes into great detail. If anyone does not stumble in word, he's a perfect man and also able to bridle the whole body. As we said, quite a bit of this chapter is about living by faith means bridling my tongue. He says here, if anyone does not stumble in word, he's a perfect, or the idea there is a mature man, able also to bridle the whole body. So stumble here has been used in this letter before, back in chapter 2 and verse 10. Whoever shall keep the law, whole law, and yet stumble in one point, he's guilty of all. Stumble here has the idea of sin. We all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, if he does not sin in the things that he says and in use of his tongue, then he would be one who's fully mature, and almost as if to, he says, able also to bridle the whole body. There's a comparison there of the difficulty of bridling the tongue compared to other members of the body. And so much so that he would say, if you're able to bridle the tongue and never sin with the tongue, then wow, that's the most difficult one of your members to control. You'd be able to take care of your whole body and control every member of it. It's kind of an illustration in a sense. And he gives two illustrations now. Two illustrations. One is putting a bit, a bridle in a horse's mouth. Indeed, we put bits in horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body. So here's a small object, a bit, in the horse's mouth that restrains such a strong and powerful animal. Small object restrains the whole body. Or, then he goes on and he says, look also at ships. Although they are so large and are driven by fierce winds, they are turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires. Here again is a small object within the ship steering an entire ship. A ship that is subject to many influences and powers outside of its own control, such as the winds and the seas. And yet, he says, they're driven by fierce winds, but there's a small rudder that can steer the entire ship. And so then in verse 5, he says, even so the tongue. Where's the comparison then? The tongue is a small object. And just like these small objects, whether it be the bit in the horse's mouth controlling one large and strong animal, or a small rudder in the ship controlling a ship in the midst of these waves and these seas like that, so the tongue is a small member in the body, and compared to the body, it's so small, yet there is great effect exercised by it. Exercised over our own self, because the things that we say can affect us too, not just others. They defile, defile the whole body. So that small thing compared to the whole, the size of this whole body, yet there's a great effect exercised by it. It's capable. This small member of our body, the tongue, is capable of the greatest good and also the most far-reaching harm. Kenny, did you have something to say?
The bit in the horse's mouth. It's a piece of metal they put in their mouth, which is has leaves that come back to you. So whichever way you pull it, it leaves its head. So mm-hmm. wherever the head goes, the body goes.
Yes.
So that's why you need to be careful with your mouth and where it goes, because that could lead your body astray.
Good. Very good, Kenny. Anything else? All right. James gives a third illustration here. Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. Again, a small fire kindles a lot of wood, or a forest of wood. The tongue, though small, is potent and powerful. There's a vast difference in size between this member, small member, which is the cause of so much trouble, and the effect that it has upon the whole body and upon others. And unlike the horse and the ship, which are controlled, the effect of the little fire and the resulting destruction really are uncontrolled. So these illustrations a little bit different, but here we have a ship controlled by a small rudder, a horse controlled and led by a small bit. But then here we have, on the negative side, we might think of it, a small fire that kindles a great fire. And the tongue is like that small fire then, that can kindle such a great fire that is what generally? Well, it's uncontrolled. Fires quickly rage out of control. Any thoughts there? Well, he wants us to bridle our tongue then. This is the lesson being taught us, to control and bridle our tongue when we understand the great power it wields. In Psalm 120 and verse 2, Psalm 120 and verse 2, just to look at some of these. Deliver my soul, O Lord, from lying lips and from a deceitful tongue. These are two ways in which we can stumble with our tongue, maybe really one, deceit or lie. Lying lips, a deceitful tongue. Proverbs chapter 26 and verses 18 to 25. Like a madman who throws firebrands, arrows, and death is the man who deceives his neighbor and says, "I was only joking." Where there is no wood, the fire goes out, and where there is no talebearer, strife ceases. Talebearer there being the idea of a gossiper or a slanderer, literally a whisperer. Well, I have a few things to say about that in a moment, but where there is no talebearer, strife ceases. There's no wood for the fire. The fire goes out. As charcoal is to burning coals and wood to fire, so is a contentious man to kindle strife. Again, contentious, I would imagine, with his words of contention that create contention and strife. The words of a talebearer are like tasty trifles, and they go down into the inmost body. Here's the harm or the defilement that comes from talebearing, gossiping, or slandering. They are like, as he says here, tasty trifles, and they go down into the inmost body, or the rooms of the belly, is a center column reference here. in my Bible. How powerful those words are then. Fervent lips with a wicked heart are like earthenware covered with silver dross. He who hates disguises it with his lips and lays up deceit within himself. When he speaks kindly, do not believe him, for there are seven abominations in his heart. Though his hatred is covered by deceit, his wickedness will be revealed before the whole congregation. Here's some ways in which to stumble with our tongue. Through not keeping our word and being deceptive, he who deceives his neighbor. Then also being a tale-bearer, a gossiper, a whisperer, or a slanderer. Words of contention that draw up fights and difficulties that are unnecessary. And then even the idea of flattery or deceit with the tongue in such a way that you're thinking one thing about one, but you'll say another. So many ways to sin with our tongue, isn't there? Psalm 15 and verses 1 through 3. David asks, Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle, who may dwell in your holy hill? He who walks uprightly and works righteousness and speaks the truth in his heart, he who does not backbite with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor does he take up a reproach against his friend. Backbiting is mentioned here, and that's the idea of saying something behind one's back, what you would never say to his face. It's very much associated with the idea of slandering another. And this ought not to be in our language, in our tongue. Proverbs 16 and 27. Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 27, yet another one here. An ungodly man digs up evil, and it is on his lips like a burning fire. The idea of one who wants to find fault and try to dig up problems, and then it's on his lips like a burning fire. Choose these here because they speak of this idea of fire. And James speaks of how the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. This is obviously the tongue in the sense of its improper use, because the tongue can also be used for great good. So the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity, he says here in verse 6. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature and is set on fire by hell. It's a fire in its improper use. Like other members of the body, it can be used for good. A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold and fittings of silver, Proverbs 25 and verse 11. But not only can it be used for good like other members of our body, but for evil, just like our hands and our feet. He says, there are then far-reaching effects of this, of the abuse of the tongue. It defiles the whole body, stains the whole body. Someone wrote that a slanderer eventually pollutes his own outlook, his own personality, his own thinking by that slander. It doesn't just have great harm to another, but he pollutes himself with all of that. He pollutes his own mind and changes his own outlook on life and on others. So there's a constant need then, and we know this, there's a constant need of restraint. No man is free in regard to this. No man can say, I've tamed the tongue and I'm done. Or one and done, as someone might say. We'll see this in a moment. Every kind of beast, verse 7, Every kind of beast and bird of reptile and creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind, but no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. No man can tame the tongue. And James does not mean to suggest that we're excused by its improper use, but I believe he's saying we can never let our guard down. The man who maybe has not sinned with his tongue for a long period of time cannot say, I'm done. It's tamed and it's over. We do that with animals, although I would suppose even with the fiercest of animals, there's a degree of caution still. But I think James here points out we've tamed animals such to the point you can tame an animal and then this animal just behaves like he's been tamed, and he'll behave that way the rest of his life. But is the tongue that way to where we can let our guard down and say, I'm forever done with that? No. So we're being taught here that we must exercise this unceasing care and sobriety and vigilance in the use of our tongue. Unceasing care. Any thoughts there? We don't know why James wrote what he did in this letter. It was to a specific some people, as described in verse 1, to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad. But did they have problems with their tongue more than some people could have been? I don't know, but every one of us can relate to this. Every one of us can relate to it. Any comments or thoughts? It's full of deadly poison. Can you imagine then what we do to another if it's got deadly poison in it? And I think of a rattlesnake that injects deadly poison in another, and we, in a sense, can inject deadly poison then into another human being. It's an unruly, restless evil. It's turbulent. It's easily agitated. Maybe someone cannot agitate you to get into a fist fight, but they can agitate you to get your tongue riled up, right? You know what I'm saying. We never think of putting and plunging a sword into the heart of another human being or into a brother, but that's what happens with the tongue when we engage in gossip or slander, harsh words, backbiting, that kind of thing. It's full of deadly poison. It's very powerful. And the power of their deadly poison. Guy?
I guess thoughts I have is the idea and power of Satan, how he's introduced a new way in which what you've been saying through here we can do through the idea of social media. And I guess I'm thinking it's not using the tongue, but then again it is how people can. And you said something a little while ago about backbiting, about saying something to somebody in which you wouldn't say that to their face. And it seems like in social media that is done really, really, really frequently. And stuff is said, is written, that just causes so much evil and tension and harm and stuff like that. That I don't know, it just seems like that's an extension of what you're talking about here that we need to be aware of as well.
Right. Very good point. Yes?
You know, words can hurt us emotionally. You know, especially when it comes from somebody you really trust. And they tell you you're no good at something, or you know, you'll never be able to do that. They put that negative thought into your brain, that you'll never succeed at that.
Yeah.
And so those are the kinds of things that we really need to be careful about saying. You know, and if you have, you know, a Christian or, you know, you have to be careful what you say to them, because you can hurt their faith.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not all about, you know, speaking bad language. It's also about hurting another person with the words that you have chosen to use. You know, we have a lot of teeth in our mouth. Why not bloody your tongue sometimes?
Right. Very good. Yeah, it's like poison, isn't it? Those thoughts.
I was going to say, then that connects back to the start of the chapter where it says, let not many of you be teachers, right? That mm-hmm. this is all connected, right? That
yes.
If you teach the wrong thing or if you say the wrong thing, you could significantly impact another person.
Yes. Good. We may not think of our tongues as full of deadly poison, even when we've said something we shouldn't have said. What I'm saying is we may downplay it in our own minds. But I believe God's view of what that is, whatever it is that we've sinned with our tongue, is like this. It's deadly poison. Psalm 140 in verse 3 says, they sharpen their tongues like a serpent. The poison of asps is under their lips. Paul quotes that in Romans chapter 3 and verse 13. And his conclusion upon saying all of these things that men do, and you and I are people, all these things that we do, his conclusion to it is in the verse that we know very well in Romans 3, verse 23. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. All I'm saying is that I can read Romans 3 and this is strong language here. Their throat is an open tomb. Their tongues, they practice deceit. The poison of asp is under their lips. Mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Feet are swift to shed blood. And I can say, well, I've never murdered a man. But if I've hated someone, and I've hatred in my heart toward them, is this not what God sees about it? Is this not what God sees? So it's a scary thought. Sin's just such an awful thing, and the way that we sin with our tongues, you know that feeling when you think back to something you said, you regret, and you can't take it back. You can apologize, you can be forgiven, but you can remember some things. I do remember things that I've said that, like, I can't believe I ever said that, you know? And seems I'll never forget I ever said that either, even though we're past it. With it, it's inconsistent. But James shows another point here. He says, so, you know, it's inconsistent that we would bless God. Verse 9. With it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men. It would be enough to stop there for me to say, well, yeah, that's inconsistent. But he says, and it really drives the point home, who have been made in the similitude of God? Do you see what we're doing when we curse men or curse someone? We wish evil upon them. The word curse, I read, is made up of a compound word from down and to curse. Put it together, it's to curse down. We bless God looking up to Him, and we curse down upon men, which shows an attitude toward others that we have. And We've been made in the image of God. Every man has been made in the similitude of God, and yet here we can find ourselves cursing men. These things ought not to be so, he says. How easy is it? Well, it's pretty easy to do. Peter, on the night of Jesus' betrayal, he said, "Not me. I won't." And then how much later was it? I don't know how many, few hours, not long. And he cursed, and "I don't know the man," and all of this, three times. It's recorded for us. And yet he's the one who would say, who said in Matthew 16, "We know that you're the Christ, the Son of the living God." He's the one who says he'll jump in and do anything for Jesus. I'm speaking, those aren't the words of the Bible, but he would just do anything, wouldn't he? He'd just jump right in. But he's able here to sin with his tongue. We have plenty of examples. We have our own to know the great control and self-control we must exercise over our tongue. Our mouths were created for holy purposes, not for sinful ones. It's inconsistent to praise God and yet curse men who are made in his likeness. And it's contrary to nature. And he gives here in James 3 this illustration. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? Thus no spring can yield both salt water and fresh. We know it to be so in nature. It teaches us something. God's creation teaches us lots of things, and teaches us even in this case that this tongue ought not to be used for both blessing and cursing. There's much we could say about the tongue and the various sins that we could have with the tongue, but just trying to move along through chapter 3. Does anyone have any comments about this? So, who is wise and understanding among you, he asks now in verse 13. Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. This is very much like what we've been reading in James, where in chapter 1 he said, don't be hearers but doers only. Don't be someone who looks in the mirror and actually observes his face, but he goes away and doesn't change anything or do anything. And then in chapter 2, he talks about faith without works is dead. Well, here he says, if you're going to be wise, if you are wise, you can't just say, I'm wise and understanding, but it will be demonstrated by good conduct. And that good conduct will be done in the meekness of wisdom. And so wisdom and understanding are seen in conduct in a godly life. And they're done in the meekness of wisdom. So wisdom, if we do work, if we are wise and understanding, if we're being wise and understanding, the things that we do will not be done in a parading way. They'll be done in the meekness of wisdom. Wisdom does not parade itself. It's not boastful and arrogant. Jesus said, wisdom is justified by her children. And in that context, I believe it was the same idea. Here he's being accused, Matthew chapter 11, if you want to turn there, Matthew 11 and verse 19. This is what they said, that the Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, look, a gluttonous man and a winebibber, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. They found fault with Jesus. Here he is with the wisdom of God, teaching all truth. But they find fault with him. Jesus says wisdom is justified by her children. Here are accusations against me, Jesus is saying, but let's see what I really am and what I really say. Wisdom is justified or shown by her children, which are her works. And James is saying a similar thing here. Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. Then he goes to a negative side here and says, if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. So bitter envy and jealousy, the idea there, and I believe it is the King James Version that has faction. The New King James says, if you have bitter envy and self-seeking, the idea is faction or a spirit of selfishness. These are works of the flesh. We can read about them in Galatians chapter 5. These kind of things are not from God. They're not from above. They're earthly, that is, of the world. They're sensual, that is, they're very base and carnal. We're not animals, but we can behave like them if we're not careful. If we just follow whatever we feel like doing and whatever my body and whatever my appetites want. And that's the idea of sensual. Demonic is reminds me that Satan himself is the author. Is the author of bitter envy and self-seeking in our hearts. The results of bitter envy and self-seeking are disorder and disturbance, conflict. It leads to confusion. And this can happen in a local church. If there's self-seeking and envy, if these issues exist within brethren, what results is disorder, disturbance, and even confusion. That makes me think how that it can be difficult even to figure out what's going on. There's just confusion. And why? Because of worldly ways and wisdom. And Paul wrote about in Romans 16, verses 17 to 18, about those who would cause faction or division. And let's read that, Romans 16, verses 17 and 18. He says, I urge you, brethren, note those who cause divisions and offenses contrary to the doctrine which you learned, and avoid them. For those who are such do not serve our Lord Jesus Christ, but their own belly, and by smooth words and flattering speech deceive the hearts of the simple. What's the danger with these kind of people Paul was talking about? They have this self-seeking, the faction. He mentioned this idea of divisions and offenses. What results from it? Disorder, disturbance, confusion, and conflict in the church. And that's why pretty strong instruction Paul gave there, as well as in Titus, regarding the self-seeking and factious person. Yes.
In Psalm 19:155, salvation is far from the wicked, for they do not seek your statutes. So the people that are wicked and of the world, they do not seek God's word. They do not turn to the Bible to make their life right.
That's right. Not seeking the right wisdom. James here is talking about what can happen with us, with Christians, if we're not careful. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking, he tells us the fruits of that, the fruits of that within our hearts. It does not just destroy our own soul, but it's harmful to others then. Self-seeking results in confusion and every evil thing will be there. But he contrasts that with the wisdom that is from above. That is, of course, God's wisdom, which in chapter 1 we're to pray for and to ask for, who gives us liberally and without reproach. He doesn't say, why are you asking me again? I don't like you asking me again and again. God's wisdom is described here as pure, is of course uncontaminated and without fault. It is God's gift. It's wholly good. It's peaceable. It produces and maintains peace. It instills peace in the heart of the one who has it. And the one who has it has peaceful pursuits. Guy Woods wrote in his commentary, "It's possible for a factious spirit and a factious... It is impossible. It is impossible for a factious spirit and a factious disposition to issue from a pure heart." So God's wisdom is first pure, then peaceable, gentle. The idea of being reasonable, fair in dealing, disposition that does not demand its rights, but is willing if necessary to suffer wrong in the cause of right. Was Jesus gentle? Depends on the occasion, right? But what did he do? I believe this word would have to do with what did he do in his trials? Did he revile in return? Did he strike back and all of that? He bore through offenses is what Jesus did. Now, Jesus was strong in his words and telling people, but he never struck back. He never returned evil for evil. He accepted plenty of it. He accepted evil for evil. He was willing to suffer wrong in the cause of right. And I believe that's the idea of this word here. Willing to yield. That is easy to be entreated. Open to reason, ever ready to hear what others have to say, and willing to yield to what is right. Willing to yield. Full of mercy, compassion, and desirous to help those who are in distress, and full of good fruits then. Fruits that demonstrate the wisdom. Without partiality, that is, without double-mindedness, not with divided opinion, and without hypocrisy, does not wear a mask, but appears just as you are in your own true character. The wisdom from that is above is that way. And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. It's sown in an environment of peace by those who want peace and make peace. Good works, the fruit of righteousness. You know, it's very important then that we give great effort to restrain our tongue, because even though it is a little member, it's capable of the most far-reaching effects. It's the most difficult member of the body to restrain, is the idea given in James chapter 3. It's impossible to tame it, to the point that it can be left unguarded. If it's unrestrained, it will defile the whole body. Earthly wisdom has different fruits than heavenly wisdom that's from above. And that means wisdom has its children. Wisdom, the wisdom that we operate by, is seen in what we do. It is seen in what we do and what we say. Because a tree is known by its fruits, and Jesus spoke about that. Make the tree good. The fruit will be good. Does anyone have any comments before we close chapter 3, Kenny?
You have 32 teeth and one tongue.
Right.
So you have 32 ways to hold back your tongue.
That's right.
Almost do.
Very good. Anything else? All right, we will pick up in chapter 4 next week. And so if you will take your material that we handed out several weeks ago and review that, we'll follow along in chapter 4.